It's Jim, it's the world of bonds. It's Friday, the 10th of June, 2022, for professional investors only, never ever investment advice. A lot going on over the past week. I was away over the Platitudes weekend in Girona and Barcelona, so a lot to be catching up with this week. The first of which is this morning's FT front page, in which Rishi Sunak, I think somewhat unfairly, is getting the blame for not forecasting or foreseeing that inflation globally was going to go up, and therefore not hedging the QE interest payments that he has to pay on behalf of the Treasury. And as a result, that has cost UK taxpayers £11 billion. And people are comparing this to Gordon Brown's sale of the gold back in the day when he was in charge of the Treasury. Again, in both cases, pretty unfair. I guess it depends what else you're doing with the money, especially in Gordon Brown's case. In his case, you could say he was investing it. On the other hand, Rishi Sunak's case, who has perfect foresight? I mean, is he meant to be gambling on which way interest rates are going up with these huge sums of money? Or is he just saying, well, we have natural hedges in terms of tax takes going up when inflation goes up? Anyway, never want to normally rush to defence of a Chancellor, but on this occasion, it does seem a little bit unfair. Great paper has come out over the past couple of weeks. Who Killed the Phillips Curve? A Murder Mystery. As always, the Fed, I think, writes the best research papers of anyone. So you can find it on the Fed's website or search for Who Killed the Phillips Curve. It talks about the conventional wisdom of monetary policy, effectively saying that, implying that policymakers have taken a lot of credit over the past few decades for falling inflation. But really, this paper puts a line under that and says, actually, you can explain 90% of the fall in inflation volatility without any input from monetary policy action at all in either direction. The thing that's determined this big fall in inflation volatility is about labour market dynamics, not about monetary policy. We've often thought this as being, the decline of the trade union, the complete collapse of the trade union over the past few decades, obviously has an impact on wage bargaining power. We've often thought that central banks have taken too much credit, but have put a lot more emphasis on things like globalisation, technology and demographics. They're saying that it's the labour market and the decline of the trade union that's the most important factor. So they're saying that, obviously, we all know this, power has moved from trade unions to firms nowadays. There is a question, though, and they don't really talk about this in a great deal of detail, but we see the headlines again early this week about train strikes in the UK later in June. We know about massive labour shortages, whether it's in food production industries or airports, for instance, and the queues there and the cancellation of holidays and so forth. And maybe we are about to see a significant rebalancing in that equilibrium between labour and capital. And as a result of that, maybe that will explain a lot of higher inflation in years to come. And I don't think you should put too much money against that outcome coming through. Right, the big news yesterday came from the ECB. It was the Lagarde press conference, as always. As I say, as I've said before, I think Lagarde and Bailey of the Bank of England haven't quite got the hang of the press conferences yet. And you'll see quite a lot of volatility throughout those press conferences, especially when Lagarde mentioned the new word of the day, fragmentation. And we'll talk about fragmentation a bit in a second. But Lagarde announced, as we knew, that net bond buying will end at the end of this month, but implied very strongly that the conditions are right now for a 25 basis point hike from the ECB in July, and another hike, potentially 50 basis points, depending on inflation dynamics, in September. And whether we've got 25 or 50 in September, this would see by then the end of this 8 years we've seen of negative ECB rates. So we'd move that to either zero if it was 25 in September, or 25 positive if we got 50 basis point hike. This means that obviously economists have been revising their hike expectations higher. So people putting in another 50 basis points in October and hikes all the way through to June next year. So Goldman Sachs, for instance, have got a terminal rate now of 1.75%. Other people, I think, have got 2% in for terminal rate for the ECB next year. As I say, an end to those nearly a decade of negative ECB interest rates and all the unintended consequences that we've talked about in the past of negative interest rates that we've seen, whether that's hoarding of cash, whether it's mortgage rates in Spain where people get sent checks and stuff like that by their bank for having a mortgage. Anyway, end to that potentially on its way. But let's talk about fragmentation, that new word. The word is being used to describe tensions and strains within European bloc member sovereign bond markets, effectively. She kind of swerved the question to some extent about it initially, saying, quote, "I want to come back to this issue of fragmentation, as I know it is dear to some." Later on, she talked about the ECB does have the tools to deal with strains within bond markets. We know that's the case. They've got tools to address liquidity and lack of liquidity in bond markets, and they've got other operations that could buy sovereign bonds from Italy or Spain if needed. So I don't think it's something that markets need to panic about, but even knowing that, bond spreads have been going up. So Italian spreads to bunds on the 10-year BTP are now out at 217 basis points. And just yesterday, on the back of that press conference, Italian bond yields were up 25 basis points at 10 years. So we've gone from 0.5% 10-year Italian bond yields to 3.5% now. That's a really significant move. And as I say, it's all about debt sustainability that people are worried about more than the liquidity thing, to be honest. So the cost of Italian debt now, you know, the Italian bond yield on average is above its average historical, the cost of new Italian debt is above the average cost of all the outstanding Italian debt, if that makes sense. And so that means that every time Italy issues a new bond at those yields above the cost of average interest rate, that will raise Italy's overall cost of debt, and there comes a level based on your potential growth rate and tax take and inflation and things like that, where your debt burden starts to increase and that starts moving at a faster and faster pace. We're not there yet, but on a number of charts that people send round, we're in kind of a red zone, a kind of, or a grey area, well, whatever you want to call it, where we're at the beginning of that movement higher from peripheral Europe. So something to keep an eye on, something to be nervous about, but I don't think something that we need to panic about straight away at this point. Okay, let's quickly talk about today's news. We are going to have some US CPI numbers later today. The market's expecting 8.3%, same as last month, with a little bit of a reduction of core inflation within that. From the headline, you know, the big thing that's going on is really a continued rise in US gasoline prices. So yesterday, the cost of a gallon of petrol went above $5 a gallon for the first time. I'm not sure how a gallon compares to a good old UK litre, but I'm sure it'll be one of the Brexit benefits that the government will make me have to learn what it means. But higher petrol prices certainly feeding through into the headline number, core a little bit more behaved. And I think when we look at some of the PPI numbers and inflation numbers that have come out in the last week or so, they do point to a moderation in the nervousness about ever higher inflation numbers. They're at least stabilizing at these still extremely high levels. So wait and see whether they do start to come down, as many people have got in their forecasts. The other big mover in markets has been around Japanese yen. That's now out at 133 to the US dollar. That's like a 20% fall against the US dollar or something like that this year alone. And it's raising a lot of questions about yield curve control. People's argument is that the weakness of the yen is being driven, you know, mainly by interest rate differentials with US treasuries, for instance, which have been rising throughout the year. I think we're a new cyclical high for the 5-year US treasury, whereas JGB yields are pinned by yield curve control, effectively unlimited QE to keep 10-year yields at 25 basis points. They're pinned there, they are banging up against that ceiling, and as we've talked about before, there does come a time when pegs break, you know, when if inflation starts rising in Japan, or if the yen keeps selling off, eventually I think that the Bank of Japan may have to do something about that peg and about its monetary policy stance. At that stage, you know, JGBs have got quite a lot of catching up to do with the moves that we've seen in global bond markets elsewhere. So it doesn't look consistent or sustainable for what's going on to carry on in perpetuity, but certainly it's led to a very, very weak outcome for the Japanese yen. So on a Big Mac index, on PPP, the yen just looks incredibly cheap fundamentally at the moment. In Asia elsewhere, more good news about relaxation of COVID restrictions in Shanghai, so that should underpin a more optimistic tone in Asian equities. But credit generally is still very, very weak again. We saw a bounce off the wides from about a month ago, but we've kind of drifted back out there once more. Lots and lots of issuance of bank bonds, for instance. So maybe a lot of the weakness is about supply and relentless supply as companies try and lock in some the last chance they might think of some cheap long-term funding. But just looking at the whole global corporate bond market at the moment, the yield on the market is now about 4% compared to a 5-year average for global credit of around 2.25%. So maybe those, you know, that big correction in credit does lead to some more demand, certainly in institutional space, and some of the big global banking groups like buy and maintain or buy and hold strategies, where they just say, okay, I'm not going to take a short-term view on markets, but I'm just going to buy a basket of bonds at these new high yields and hold them for the foreseeable future. Anyway, not yet seeing lots of that happening, but that potentially with yields where they are now, we are at a more attractive level for those kind of trades to take place. Right, have good weekends. I'll catch up with you next week. Bye.